By the way, everybody who, if you have signed up to go out to the party tonight, you definitely want to make all your plans completed at the registration table. If you haven't picked up your goal ticket or made some other arrangement to be on the wait list, but make sure you do that before you leave, because we've certainly sold it out. Limited amount of people can be there. So last of the housekeeping in that regard. Our last speaker is on the advisory board of Normal. He doesn't need hardly an introduction if you watch PBS, because it's impossible not to see him on that spectrum on the TV. He's a mainstay. He's a best-selling author, arguably the best-selling travel author in the United States, maybe ever. I don't know if it's still true, Rick, that you sell more Eurorail passes outside of Eurorail. You sell more Eurorail passes than almost as much as this. I mean, second only to the Eurorail system itself. Yeah. So he's a very, very business-oriented person who has really melded, I mean, some would argue the best in life is when you put your vocation and avocation together. And Rick has truly done that in his company, Europe Through the Back Door, which is a very diversified company out of Edmonds, Washington. The theme of this particular speech is the idea that some years ago, Rick used to just send donations to Normal, $50, $100 donations, and one day we saw his name. You know, I said, Rick Steves? Is that the Rick Steves? I used to get his books and go to Europe and wear a money belt to bed. I did. I was afraid someone was going to steal my money and my passport. So wrote to him and said, you know, are you the Rick Steves? And he wrote back essentially, yep, that's me. And said, would you like to get more involved? I said, well, maybe. And it took a couple of years before finally Keith made a connection with him. And I'm sure Rick will probably allude to that. But the theme of this speech is kind of coming out from just being a checkbook supporter to Normal to one of the most articulate and now quoted spokespersons for marijuana law reform in the United States, the Lutheran of the Year 2008, Rick Steves.
That's funny.
All right.
Thank you very much. Let's see if I'm gonna. All right. Well, that's not going to stay up. There we go. I'm going to just hold it. Okay. Thank you, Alan. It's great to be here. In preparation for having a chance to share some ideas with you, a couple days ago I had dinner with a leading policeman in my city who's working on narcotics issues, and I learned a lot from him. And I think it's good to inject a little bit of what's the mindset of the people who are standing between us and victory in this war against the prohibition against marijuana. And I realized he's a good man. He cares about our communities just like we do. And he marveled at all the energy I put into this. And he, at the end of the dinner, he said, why are you doing this? He'd been to take my talks. He'd been taking notes. He knows I'm putting stuff on the line. I'm traveling all over the country to talk about this. And he also knows I live in a part of the country where I can smoke pot for the rest of my life. I can send emails to my friends and invite them over to smoke pot, and it's no risk. Why do I care? And at first it kind of stumped me. And then I thought about it a little more because it really stuck with me. And I thought, you know, I'm a travel writer. And for me, high is a place. And there better be a very good reason for my government to say I can't go there. And there is no reason. We should be able to go there if we want to. Yeah. I simply have enjoyed smoking marijuana all of my adult life. And I've got a lot of friends who are very respected in our community who smoke a lot of just recreational pot. I mean, they're not, you know, they're not high all the time, but whenever they want to socially smoke some pot, they do. And they live double lives. They're hiding it. And I just thought, this is insulting. It's absolutely insulting, a law that makes good people criminals. And I've been thinking about this for 20 years, really, and I've been working with Normal for close to a decade. And it's so clear to me that the responsible adult use of marijuana as a recreational drug is flat out a civil liberty. And, you know, this policeman had gone to one of my talks, and I gave a talk, and it was an hour-long talk on this issue, and he said he disagreed with almost everything I said, except for the fact that this is a civil liberty. And if we can figure out a way to enjoy our civil liberties without causing a problem, I think law enforcement wouldn't have any, the public in general, the feared people, would have no problem with this. We need to be smart about this. We need to think, how can we establish our civil liberties without scaring people over the downside of pot? And what are the downsides? Well, people think that abuse of drugs is harmful to society, and it is. Drug abuse, marijuana abuse, causes harm. It causes harm to people who can't handle it. It causes harm to other people who get in the way if they do something because they're intoxicated. We need to acknowledge that. I think that while you and I might be able to handle it, I think they want to hear out there that we acknowledge that it can be at least psychologically addictive to people with weaker characters. I think we need to acknowledge that if we're going to get people to listen to us. Invariably, people will drive when they are drunk or high and hurt people. Of course, you may think differently, but that's not going to sell out on Main Street. We need to acknowledge the fact that if you drink while intoxicated on anything, we should be the first people to say they should throw the book at us if we hurt somebody. And we need to respect the fact that parents and police are passionate about the safety and the well-being of children. We need to acknowledge that, and we need to respect it, and we need to be aggressive and proactive in accommodating these fears. Parents are scared to death about this. So, you know, a lot of this get-together is just a pep rally for all of us activists who aren't afraid by it, and we know that it's just a cool thing. But the fact is, half of our society out there is afraid of it, and we need to understand what makes them tick. I'd love to talk about all the numbers that we know and the incarceration figures and use doesn't go up and it's just a parallel to alcohol prohibition, but I think we all know that stuff right now. So in this talk, I'm just going to share my take on it as a travel writer, as a Europhile, and as somebody who in mainstream community as a business and community leader has spoken out on this proudly and what it's like and what have I learned and what are the pitfalls and so on. My work is, as a travel writer, to bring a European sensitivity home to the United States. And I find that when you travel and you leave our country, you can see the challenges and the beauties and the bad side of our country in high contrast. It's so helpful to go away and look back, and then you can see stuff. And one thing I see is a real jolt when I come back home here in the land that prides itself in being the land of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We're about the most uptight country on this planet. We really are. And, you know, you get home and you realize we're living here in a country that has the shortest vacations in the rich world. Europeans know that if they worked as hard as we did, the last day they would need to go to work every year is October 24. The rest of the year would be vacation time. We're working ourselves crazy here, and we don't even think twice about it. It's fascinating to me, and it's not good for my business because I'm selling vacations. I've got a friend who's a Greek. He spent most of his life in the United States working, and then he retired and went back to the old country like a lot of Greeks do. When he went back to Greece after 20 years in the east coast of the United States, he realized he never once took a nap while he was in the United States. It just wasn't an option. Now he goes home and he realizes, hey, if you're a little sleepy in the afternoon, you take a nap. Doesn't matter if it's bad for business. You're sleepy. Take a nap. It's okay. I was just in Germany, and when I'm in Europe, I'm crossing paths with all of our tours. I met one of our group leaders in Baden-Baden, famous for its spa, mineral spa, and I'm excited as a tour guide to get Americans naked with Germans. It's a souvenir they'll never forget. And I was saying to the guide, aren't you excited your group's going to go to the spa tonight, and have you prepared them for it and everything? And they said, none of the Americans are going. It was the German guy who works for me, but he was just said, we've given up on Americans. They're so uptight about nudity, they can't take their clothes off at a spa with Germans. The last thing a German's going to do is look at an American's private parts, okay? It's just not a big deal over there, but Americans can't handle it. I make TV shows, and believe it or not, I have to concern myself with how much frontal nudity I'm going to show when it comes to making a TV show of 500-year-old canvas breasts painted by Titian or a 2,000-year-old marble penis. You can't show that and run your show before 10 p.m. in some markets of this country. That's kind of perverse, I would say. So I'm trying to bring home a sensitivity to this kind of thing from a European perspective. And of course, when it comes to drugs, that's a whole similar situation. I got friends in Barcelona. Friday evening, kids are in bed. Their friends get together. They relax with a joint. And they know they're not going to be drug tested on Monday. It's just a way of life in Europe, and it's just not a big deal. I come back to the United States, and I realize we are living a lot of lies. We are embracing a lot of lies. And the evil of the responsible use of marijuana is one lie too many. That's why I'm in this. I believe that the war on marijuana is a wrong-minded prohibition of our generation. I think it's costly in many ways and it's proven to be counterproductive in even what it's trying to accomplish. And we all know with the stroke of a pen, our government could put an end to America's favorite illegal pastime. They could legalize it. And of course, then they could regulate it and tax it. We could enjoy it and they could focus what they should be doing on the problems of drug abuse, whether it's people who can't handle their alcohol or their marijuana or their hard drugs. That's what we need to do with our drug policy.
90 seconds.
Now, as a travel writer, I think about why am I here today, why would I spend a couple of days here learning about this, I can blame my travel writing. I've spent a third of my life living in Europe out of a carry-on the airplane-sized suitcase with my money belt. I've been surrounded by people who find different truths to be self-evident and God-given. People who don't have the American dream, they've got the Bulgarian dream, or the Norwegian dream, or the Moroccan dream. And I celebrate that. It's really quite cool. And I've developed a European perspective. And I can come home and remind people that, wow, travel humbles us in our self-assuredness. It wipes out our ethnocentricity. We find that people do things differently, and that's something that's pretty fun. I always thought this meant yes, but in Bulgaria, this means yes. That can cause confusion when you're in Bulgaria. Can I go here? Yes. Okay, well, what do you really mean? Yes, go there. All right. In France, slow service is good service. That's kind of fun to figure out. Hey, take all the time you want. We're not trying to turn the tables. I was in Japan once, very cold. They don't have central heating. I was there in the middle of the winter. Got up, had to go to the bathroom, slipped on my too small kimono. Slipped into my little slippers that my heels were hanging out the edge, shuffled gingerly down the hall, kind of dreading. You could see your breath. It was so cold. Dreading sitting on the toilet in the middle of that dark night in the mountains of Japan. Sat down on that toilet, and the seat was heated. And I just thought, travel is so cool. People do things differently. Who'd ever think about heating the toilet seat and not the whole room? All right, you learn, you go home. Travel also addresses your fears. Think of how much fear there is in our society. There's fear about everywhere you look, there's fear. That's how people take advantage of you. And there's certainly a lot of fear when it comes to the issue of drug use and drug abuse. In my travels, I find that the flip side of fear is understanding. When you understand something, you fear it less. I went to Iran a year ago, and I was afraid to go to Iran. I came within this far of leaving my big expensive camera in Athens, and we'd take our little sneak camera in there because I thought people would be throwing stones at us on the streets of Tehran once they knew we were an American film crew. I got over there. I've never received such a friendly welcome in my whole life, especially when they knew we were Americans. I was a little concerned about this death to America business. I was stuck in a traffic jam in Tehran. A lot of traffic jams in Tehran. A lot of traffic jams. Suddenly, my driver just bursts out, "Death to traffic." I thought, what? I thought it was death to America or death to Israel. I said, no, here in Iran, anytime anything's frustrating to us and out of our control, we say death to that. I suppose it's death to election fraud these days, you know. It's just a very interesting way to go there and learn that you don't need to be as afraid of death to America as you think they want you to be afraid of. I was in Iran wondering what makes these people tick. We're a little bit nervous by what makes Iranian ticks. Do they want to nuke us or something? A woman crossed the street and pounds her finger on my chest and say, "We're united, we're strong, and we want you to go home and tell the truth. We don't want our children to be raised like Britney Spears." They're scared to death that their little kids are going to become boy toys and drug addicts and crass materialists. They're threatened by some foreign influence coming into their society and changing their family values. Wow, I learned they're as manipulated by propaganda with fear as we are. And we're all motivated by fear and love. We need to overcome that fear. And when you travel, you can overcome fear. A lot of us see these whirling dervishes, and they just kind of, they're freaky Muslim monks, and they whirl until they get dizzy, and then what are they going to do? Then you talk to one of them, and you realize, oh, I didn't know what's going on. They plant one foot in their hometown. The other foot goes around and around, acknowledging the beauty and the variety and the diversity on this beautiful planet. They raise one arm up to accept the love of their creator, and the other arm goes down to pour God's love on all of his beautiful creation. They spin in that circle, they get into a beautiful trance, and they meditate on that beautiful thought. Suddenly, those freaky whirling monks aren't so scary. Suddenly, it's a beautiful thing. When you travel, it carbonates your life. You look at things from a different perspective. And I believe many of us, when we enjoy marijuana, it carbonates our life. It allows us to look at things with a different perspective. And like travel, it broadens our perspectives. It can be a good thing for that reason. Now, I'm a travel writer, and my job is, I get to decide what my job is because I'm self-employed, and I define my job as bringing home realities and invade Americans' comfort zones. We tend to be very comfortable. We don't want to be too stimulated. And as a travel writer, I get to go over there, learn about foie gras, learn about the force feeding of the geese, film it, come home, and make people watch it. Force feeding of the geese, ah, the foie gras. And people are just, you can't treat geese like that. Stuff them with corn 4 times a day until their livers grow from 1/4 pound to 2 pounds and then slaughter them and eat the beautiful livers. I say, yes, you can. They're delicious. And they say, well, that's not nice. And I say, well, what are we doing to our chickens? And then I say, those French, they realize those geese are designed to gorge, build big livers so they can migratory fly all the way to Egypt. And one day, centuries ago, a Frenchman caught one of those geese with a fat liver on his way to Egypt, slaughtered it, ate the liver, and thought, this is delicious. And they thought, hey, we could save these geese the trip to Egypt and eat their livers right here. Well, that's foie gras. That's a different look at foie gras. I have a matter of principle when it comes to bringing home realities that I will not take a group to Germany without going to a concentration camp. I want to honor the wish of the victims of the Holocaust that we never forget. So that's an ethic. A lot of people say, I don't want to know about that. You got to know about it. I'm sorry. I'm taking you there. I won't take a group to Ireland without going to Northern Ireland because I want people to know the consequences of a political initiative designed to plant people from one country to another to establish your rule and control of a region. London planted Protestants from Scotland into Ireland. Today, Ireland has bloodshed. Russia planted Russians into Estonia. Today, Estonia's got problems. Israel plants settlers in Palestine. These are problems people will be reaping and dealing with for generations. And we need to learn that in our travels. A lot of people are afraid of other religions. It's fun to get into people's comfort zones that way. I come from a Christian family. We say thank you every time we eat. When my son was 4 years old, my grandpa would come over, who's scared to death about Allah. And I used to teach my son to finish our Christian prayers by saying, Allah, Allah, Allah. Freaked out his grandpa, but he needed to get out of his comfort zone to realize that there was an alternative viewpoint. The same thing about the treatment of drugs. In Europe, a joint is about as exciting as a can of beer. And I think we need to bring that home, that the sky did not fall in Europe when they stopped arresting pot smokers. Now, a trip is a lot like a trip. Whether it's a passport or a joint that got you there, you're going somewhere and it's fun. If you can't afford to travel, you can travel vicariously with the help of a little marijuana, I think. I love to go up into our cabin high in the mountains in Washington State, give me a little excuse to relax there, pull out a National Geographic. Pretty soon I'm climbing Mount Everest. You know, I can feel the altitude. I can feel the danger is palpable and the jubilation when I summit. It's really quite nice. When you travel and you smoke a little pot, I think you get travel squared. You get super travel. I don't know if you've done that, but travel's good. And travel can be better. I never smoked pot until I was a young adult in Afghanistan. I was pretty determined not to let peer pressure make me do something that I didn't know I wanted to do or not. I got to Afghanistan, and it's just what you do. It's going with, I mean, what the locals do, you know. I mean, there's a rest stop on your bus ride across the country. Everybody's sitting in a circle watching a goat get slaughtered and passing around a bong. Okay, I guess this is Afghanistan. You know, you stand on the rooftop of your hotel and torchlit chariots are going by. You swear the light bulbs are breathing and people are eating soup with their hands. And then you go to Nepal and you get a chance to meet with the living virgin goddess, and all of a sudden a leech is attacking you in slow motion, determinedly coming end over end at you, and a little girl says, "Namaste." When you read that in your journal, you don't know where you were high and where you were straight, you know. You can kind of say, that's too dreamy to be real. I must have been high, or maybe Nepal's just that good. I honestly don't know. I read a few years later and I just go, man, Nepal is good. Or I don't know, maybe the pot was good there, but it was a good experience. When I do a travel writing workshop, people ask me for some tips, and I say, well, play with perspective. Play with lighting. You know, photographers play with lighting. Shoot into the sun. Break some rules. And as a writer, I find that if you've had a little experience, traveling in my case and smoking some pot, and journal writing, it heightens your ability to be an observer. Most of what you write seems great when you write it, and obviously the next morning it's not that great. But, you learn skills that stay with you, that really give you an ability to twist reality a little bit and look at it in the way Picasso might look at something as a cubist. You take this vase, you break it, and you spread all the shards on a canvas, and you can see the whole thing at the same time. That's just a fun challenge for us who are so raised in one way to see things. You can sit on a bed in Cairo and study a fly rubbing his front feet together and know that's the time you can kill him, when he rubs his feet together. You can look at Michelangelo's David, and you can actually see him sizing up the giant. And you can also see Michelangelo's point that David is sizing up the darkness of medieval Europe and slaying it as a triumph of humanism. When you're traveling, you can go to Bali and hear a gamelan orchestra churning and these quivering long fingernails of the dancers under a full moon. And boy, you've got lots to write about. And when you're in the Netherlands, you walk on those back streets and it's like you're in a Vermeer painting. All of that carbonates your experience. As a tour guide, it's just in my blood. For 25 years, I've taken groups around trying to make their experience more vivid. And I remember when I went to Morocco with a group once, just 8 people and me in a little hill town in Morocco, Chechouan. It's a place in the Rif Mountains, famous for its marijuana. And we were all a little on edge because it's scary when you're in Morocco. I know it was a long time ago and we didn't know what was up. And we're walking through this village and it's just like biblical. It's just incredible, otherworldly kind of experience. Suddenly a man in a flowing robe steps out of a dark alley with a pipe and he says, "Do you want to smoke some hash?" And I looked at him and I looked at my group and they're all like this. And I looked at him again and I said, "Yes, I do." And I was just being a good tour guide. I knew my group would never touch it, and I knew they were scared to death, but I wanted them to have the experience of being high in Morocco. So as a good, hardworking tour guide, I got high, and I narrated the experience to them through the rest of that town as we paddled up those rivers of cobblestones, and we looked into people's little glimpses of their daily life through their candlelit windows. And it was quite a good experience, and I think it was an example of how you can carbonate things when you look at it a certain way. Now, in part of my guiding work is to take this European scene and bring it home, whether it's a passion for wind power or whether it's the ability of Swedish people to give 16 hours of paid paternal and maternal leave for a baby who's born, or whether it's the treatment of drug problems anywhere in Europe. We can find that Europeans are dealing with the same challenge as we are, and we can learn from how they're tackling it. Now, there's a fundamental difference in how Americans look at drugs and how European authorities look at drugs. I believe what we measure our drug policies in, how many people do we incarcerate? That's how we measure how effective our nation's drug policies are. In Europe, they have a whole different concept. They measure the effectiveness of their drug policy by a concept called harm reduction. They believe if you take the crime out of it and treat it as a health problem, that's just a pragmatic, better way to do it. They've found for every dollar every euro they invest in education and counseling, they save 15 euros of police and healthcare costs. This is just smart, pragmatic policy. When you go to and it's not all the way across the board. Dr. Craig Reinerman helped me a lot on this. Certain countries we think of are poster children countries for progressive drug policies, and much of Europe is as regressive as we are. But when you go to parts of Europe that are more progressive, you find there's this celebration of tolerance. You go to a small town anywhere in the Netherlands, and, you know, you're on the main square. I'm thinking of the town of Haarlem here. And people are enjoying their cafe, their outdoor cafes and the beautiful chimes of the church. And then they go down here, and there's a little red light district where there's lonely men and girls flirting with them in the windows. And then down here, there's a coffee shop where people are just staring at the bubbles in their bongs. And there's policemen walking two by two around the town. Look like they're on dates, you know. And it's just, everything is just so idyllic. And you learn they incarcerate one-eighth of the people we do. One-eighth. And they have this easygoing respect, and they tell me, time and time again over there, they tell me, a society has to make a choice. Tolerate alternative lifestyles, or build more prisons. That's the choice you have to make. Europe is good at differentiating, I think, between hard drugs and soft drugs. There's drug abuse in soft drugs and hard drugs, but they make quite a clear difference. It's fun to look at their website. I studied the EU website, and the only marijuana reference or cannabis reference I could find was problem cannabis use. And there's even consultation centers all over the place where people can drop in if they're, you know, if cannabis is getting the better of them and so on. In France, they figured cannabis use among young men or teenage boys was caused by their nervousness around girls. They thought they could be bolder socially after a little bit of marijuana. So they actually established, you know, like flirting lessons for these kids, hoping that if they got more confident, they'd smoke less pot. Well, this doesn't always work, but it's a creative, progressive, harm reduction approach to drugs that I think has proven more effective than what we've been doing in our society. Now, when you look at the pragmatism and the passion for harm reduction you have in Europe, you can look at it in their treatment of hard drugs, of alcohol, and of marijuana. When it comes to alcohol, when I go to Scandinavia in May and June, the streets are filled with noisy, drunk teenagers in flatbed trucks. What are they doing? It's graduation time. They're all graduating. And parents in Scandinavia hire trucks with drivers, and they sponsor the keggers. And the kids go from one family to the next. The parents are hosting the keggers, and these kids just get shit-faced, and they don't have to lie to their parents. That'd be a tough sell to loving American parents that just say, don't drink because I don't want you to drive and drink and die on the roads. Well, the kids have to lie to their parents, and some American kids needlessly die on the roads at graduation time because the parents can't tackle it in a more realistic and pragmatic way like Scandinavian parents might. When it comes to hard drugs, boy, I just think it's fascinating to see how they do this. I was at a coffee shop, or a Starbucks in Zurich, went down into the basement, go to the bathroom, step into the bathroom, blue lights. You can't see your veins. Couldn't shoot up if you wanted to. Blue lights in the public restrooms in Switzerland. I was just in Estonia, blue lights in Estonia. They've got junkies on the street. Now, that's pretty frustrating to have a junkie not being able to find his veins. Across the street, he's got bolted to a railing is a machine that used to sell cigarettes. Now it sells government-subsidized syringes. And down the small street over there, there's a place called Cafe Fix. Cafe Fix. It's a heroin maintenance clinic where people can go without the terror of where they're going to get their next fix, without the wonder of what kind of stuff am I shooting up, with counseling and nursing and get-a-job programs and help. And they find that this works really well. They've taken the crime out of it. They're treating it as a health problem. The consequence, in the last year in the United States, we lost 18,000 people to heroin overdoses, and in Europe, according to the statistics that I looked at, they lost 8,000 people, less than half the deaths. A lot of tourists go over and they say, what's with all these junkies on the street? Well, they're still alive and they're not in jail. That's the big difference. Now, when it comes to marijuana, we know the story in the Netherlands. These coffee shops, they have not arrested people since 1976 for marijuana in Amsterdam or in the Netherlands. Part of my guidebook research tour, I've got a guidebook on Amsterdam, so I have to check these things out. It's fun just to observe, you know. They've got loner bongs. People are dropping by to read their email and take a couple of hits. Older clients don't like the edgy vibe, so they come and get their pot to go. The police like it because there's a bulletin board where they can post notices about dangerous chemical drugs on the streets. The police actually find the coffee shops a very good way to communicate to the recreational drug users in the community and let them know what they need to know so they can communicate to them in a harm reduction kind of way. They actually have found in 25 years of this kind of approach that marijuana use has not gone up markedly, and the hard drug taking community is not going up, but it is aging. So there's none of this gateway approach. They believe people go through stages. It's a big deal for us tourists to go to the Netherlands. Hey, you can buy a joint in the coffee shop. For the Dutch people, it's kind of juvenile for a lot of them, and they say some people are in it, some they aren't. Most of the people have never even been in a coffee shop. It just is a way that there is a section of their society that can exercise a civil liberty without breaking a law. Now, the trends in the Netherlands for these coffee shops are interesting. I just talked to John Foster the other day, who's the owner of the Gray Area. It's a great little coffee shop in, if you know, the Gray Area. And John's an interesting guy. He's an American expat. He lives there. He's the only American I know. Well, I guess there's a lot of Americans nowadays that are running dispensaries, but he's just selling pot as a recreational drug and making money on it. I asked him what's going on. He said, when there's some setback for marijuana policy or marijuana users in the Netherlands, the media makes it sound much worse than it is. And from the United States, it looks like the sky is falling over there. And he said, the media always overstates it. For instance, right now, there's a big buzz that they're making, the Dutch are concerned that it's becoming tourism, so they're going to make everybody have a local residence card who can use the coffee shops. Well, that's overstating the problem or the issue. There's just a few border towns that are famous among Germans and Belgians and French where they come in and it becomes a way to supply marijuana to those countries, and that's causing a problem to the Dutch, so they're making those cities sell only to local people, not to people that come in to take it over the border. But they're not going to be changing their approach to coffee shops. They have closed down 40 coffee shops in Amsterdam recently because they're within 300 meters of schools. So, you know, they're concerned about this sort of issue, which does make sense, I would say. You've got a situation where they can't advertise. As we've been talking about today, you know, it's one thing to gain legalization, but then what do you do? It's a complicated issue. I spent 2 days with a bunch of lawyers at the King County Bar Association in Seattle with just the hypothetical situation, okay, we've legalized it, now what do we do? It's quite complicated. What do you do next? And in the Netherlands, they've sort of done this through 22 or 25 or 30 years of quasi-legalization, and they have a situation, for instance, where you can't advertise. A tourist goes into a coffee shop. A lot of times I go into a coffee shop, and what's the deal? How do I know what to buy? Oh, if you want to know what's for sale, you have to push a button which illuminates the menu. But I have to physically push a button and hold it down in order to see what's for sale to cover them legally because they can't bring the information to me. I have to seek out the information. It's just a legal fine point, but that is one consideration they have. They don't want marijuana advertised to the general community, and you'll notice they're quite good at that. There's still the gray area of wholesaling, and they just kind of haven't found out how to deal with that. They're no longer importing marijuana from other countries. You don't get this Pakistan stuff or this Moroccan stuff. According to John, they have got the technology now in Amsterdam to grow stuff locally that has the same characteristics of all of these imported strains. The big news is that the mayor of Amsterdam is concerned there's too many petty deliveries because they have a limit of 500 grams for inventory. A coffee shop can lose its license if it has more than half a kilo of pot in its supply at any one time. Well, they could sell a ton of pot, but they just have to get lots of little deliveries of half a kilo each time, about 1 pound. The mayor wants to double the allowable inventory to 1 kilo. Can you imagine a mayor advocating to double the allowable inventory to 1 kilo? This is pragmatic stuff. This is really quite enlightened stuff as far as I'm concerned. Now, of course, the numbers are hard to put your finger on, and it's really frustrating in my work, and probably yours too, to figure out what are the right numbers. All of the numbers we like are put together by people who agree with us, and you look at the other numbers that people who disagree with, they've got different numbers. I think it's pretty clear in the Netherlands, teens smoke half per capita what American teens do. Government statistics on our side and their side agree to that. Whatever it is, we smoke far more than they do with much more of a legal problem associated with the use. The conclusion you can draw from that is, I think, there is not a reservoir of people who just wish they could ruin their lives smoking pot if only it was legal. If it's legal, use will not go up measurably. And I think that's a very important thing to communicate to the nervous public out there because there's a lot of nervous people out there. Now, my dinner with this policeman the other night was fascinating, and I think it's a shame we don't have a reasonable voice that disagrees with us at a convention like this to learn what they're thinking. And let me just share some things I came away from that. The driving mission is to protect kids and stop violence. Cops don't care to evaluate the law. They simply enforce whatever law's on the books. If we can change the law, they're fine with that. They'll just enforce it. The cops see that the vast majority of people that they encounter making trouble and that they have to book are either drunk or high on something. And from their experience-based mindset, drugs are just an integral part of the problem. As far as medical marijuana goes, they're insulted by it because they think it's just a smokescreen protecting recreational users. And they said people go to the get their cards and so on, and they never say they got glaucoma because that can't be verified. They've got chronic pain, which can't be verified. Maybe everybody does have a little chronic pain. They should all be medicating. But that is an insulting thing to a lot of people in this issue. He confirmed that Czar Kerlikowski no longer uses the term war. He said anytime anybody uses the term harm reduction in law enforcement, that just means they're for legalization. For 8 years, if you had a program and you proposed it to the Bush administration, if it had harm reduction in it, it was rejected without even being read, you know. But harm reduction is a catchphrase that we use and they don't like. He said today kids get nearly no drug education in school and they think they should get more. He said the reality is the smart adult use for people who are using good discretion and who are not, I mean, of course, there's a lot of racism and a lot of classism on this, but well-off people in the suburbs, they can smoke pot pretty much with no risk these days. And he said drug use among kids has declined for 8 years in a row. So that's what they think. That's how they counter us, and they really are pretty well versed in that. He said, if I want the opposition to hear me and to be credible with the opposition, I need to acknowledge that children need to be protected from marijuana use, that smoking marijuana is not healthy and it can at least be psychologically addictive. Acknowledge that driving while impaired is a problem and should be strictly targeted by law and enforced. He said that whether pot is legal or not, we need to promote treatment available free to everybody who wants it, incredible education in schools, and we need to use credible numbers and sources. And he said again that the case for civil liberties makes a lot of sense to him. We just have to cover society's nervousness about innocent victims and children. Now, I've been speaking on this for like a long time, and it's my fun challenge as a well-known person in the area of travel writing to just come out and be open about that and honest with it. And it's an exhilarating thing. I'm not gay, so I never had the opportunity to come out that way, but I think it must feel good to finally not be hiding something. There's a lot of people that are afraid to come out, and what I can say is I've done it as publicly as possible, and it's been a plus for me across the board. Now, every chance I get, I talk about this in conservative cities on the media. And I'll tell you, reporters are scared to death to show their colors on this because they care about their job security. Advertising, or media managers are worried about offending their advertisers, so they're nervous about this. But as soon as the mic turns off, everywhere in the United States I've been, the reporter goes, wow, right on. The reporter is with us. They just are scared to death for their job security. Now, I think that when you believe like we do, we need to take this in an unscary way to Main Street. And I think there's a lot of community leaders that need to be sat down with and explain the rationale for our thinking in a way that is reasonable. I've made a point to talk with my mayor, my pastor, the leading priest in our town, school teachers, the Rotary Club, and every elected official I can get my hands on. They all know loud and clear what I'm about. I just was the keynote speaker at the Snohomish County Democratic Party annual fundraising event, and I talked for an hour, and 15 minutes of that was drug policy, and that's where all of my applause lines were, in drug policy, talking to the Democratic Party. I think the time is ripe, but we've got to bring it to them in a reasonable, unscary way. I produced a 30-minute documentary with the ACLU. They spent a lot of money on this. They used Washington State as a test market, and I wanted all my European kind of stuff to get in, and they said, we've poll tested that. That doesn't work with our target market. Our target market is the scared soccer moms. I said, okay. And they went at it with a very high-minded, unscary thing. Moms just don't want their kids to get a record and not get loans at school or anything like that. There's a lot of important concerns for these scared soccer moms, and I think this is what we have to be sensitive to. I think that we need to just desensitize people to the basic word marijuana. I love to do a charity in my business and give people a choice. You can support, you can write a check to, you know, Bread for the World, Greenpeace, the YWCA, or Normal. And you do that and it makes people put Normal in there with the YWCA. I think it's just a great thing to do. In your work, you can talk marijuana. Okay, I make a point to use the word marijuana in every one of my 20 guidebooks. Sometimes it's a stretch, but I can do it. Check it out. Now, some people have told me, okay, we're going to boycott your books and we're never going to take one more of your tours because of what you think about marijuana. And all I can think is, well, Europe will be more fun without you. I mean, can you imagine? I'll tell you, marijuana makes corporations very nervous. I think people are ahead of the politicians, and politicians are ahead of the corporations. Corporations are scared to death about this issue. Look what happened to Kellogg's and Michael Phelps, you know. I got some underwriting, and not very much, but on my TV show. But in order to get it again, I had to sign a document from their lawyer promising I would not advocate smoking marijuana on my website. They are scared to death about what a two-bit celebrity might say about this because they're associated with him. We've got to educate the corporations that it's good business to be reasonable about the civil liberty of smoking marijuana recreationally. It's very important. The ACLU produced that show at great expense, and we assumed we could buy time on the local marketplace there on one of the big three networks. None of them would let the ACLU pay their going rate to run this for half an hour before midnight. One of them let us run it at 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that. But by the way, we showed it at lunch yesterday, but people were busy and a lot of people missed it. If you're curious about this ACL video, I think it's a very interesting piece just to look at from a education and raising awareness point of view to see how they're doing it. If you just Google ACLU, Rick Steves, marijuana, you can watch it. It's a 30-minute thing. And if you want to show it to a group or whatever, I think it works very well. I've been taking it on the road with legislators in my state and with the ACLU. We had 700 people in the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, and we showed it to them, and then we talked about it. We did it in Kirkland. We're doing it in my hometown in a couple weeks. And it's exciting to bring it to your community with local legislators to take the fear out of this issue. Very important. My advice, if you're going to be taking this to the public, is be a good citizen. You need to cause them confusion. You need to look well-scrubbed and somebody that they'd like for a babysitter, and then let them know what you really think about drug policy. I'm, as Alan mentioned, I get these awards with my church or with the media. I was flown to Washington, D.C. by the State Department to get the Citizen Diplomat of the Year Award a couple of months ago. In my town, they want me to run for Congress. I mean, I can't believe it. Well, I think it's a loopy idea, but they really think, and I said, but what about all this normal stuff? And they said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I don't think the politicians get it. But we have Roger Goodman in our city in Seattle. He ran. Every time his opponent tried to assassinate his character, saying he's a drug pusher, Roger's numbers spiked. And this worthless guy went down. People are smarter now because of the work we're all doing. Now, I'll tell you, my goal is to force frightened people to have no choice but to like a pot smoker. That's your challenge, all right? There's a lot of fear out there. People are afraid of black people. People are afraid of gays. People are afraid of pot smokers. If you know a black person, if you know a gay person, half of our country has never met a gay person. Half of our country has only seen people like you and me in the news with a lot of bad B-roll that makes us look like dangerous people. We got to bring it to them and disarm that fear. We got to whiten our teeth and wash our hair and peel off the angry bumper stickers and go to PTA meetings and talk about it without letting it be so frightening to these people. You know, I think the government has spent $1 billion advertising to make marijuana look scary. We've got a lot to overcome there. We need to be credible. I mean, even if you think hemp can save the world and it's the miracle weed, I think that's kind of creepy in the mainstream. It's creepy, I got to say, even to me, all right? It's a civil liberty. That's what's saleable, okay? It's a civil liberty, and it's nothing to be afraid of. So if we can let the public know that good people enjoy marijuana recreationally, we're doing a huge step in the right direction.